Well, good morning, South Point. It's great to see you guys. If you're new to us, by way of introduction, my name is Matt. I'm the lead pastor here. I am so glad you're here with us, worshiping our living King. And this morning, if you are new, or if you're not new, we're in the middle of a series called Snapshots. This is actually the 10th sermon in the series. We're calling it Snapshots because I like to imagine looking at a photo album, flipping through the pages, and we're looking at snapshots from the life of Jesus, particularly how Jesus interacted with and engaged with people. Now, as a sort of a parenthetical part of our series, for the last 3 weeks, we've looked particularly at how Jesus engaged with and interacted with women. We'll conclude this little excursus as part of our series this morning, looking at how he engaged with one last woman. But before I get into the sermon, I wanted to kick it off this morning with a name association game. So I'm going to say a word, and then I want you to imagine what this person would look like, okay? Number one, NFL football player. What do you imagine? Big or little? Big, right? Big, wide, impossibly large, yet incredibly fast, rich, maybe dysfunctional, I don't know. Think about NFL football player. Number two, runway model. Runway model. What do you think about? Daryl Jones, don't you? Yeah, no, you think about, you know, I think about this sort of a stick skinny girl, with a very angsty, like a forlorn look on her face, sunken eyes, wearing clothes that none of us would ever wear in a million years. How about this one? Computer engineer. What do you think? Yeah. I think about, you know, somebody whose glasses are taped together, pocket protector, jokes that nobody laughs at, you know, that kind of thing. Lastly, a holy person. What do you think about? Yeah, you probably didn't think about your spouse, did you? I want to talk about this concept of holiness today. And a lot of times we hear this word holiness and you go, okay, that seems maybe, I think about somebody with too much starch in their collar, somebody who is kind of irrelevant, someone who maybe sits around on Friday night reading the King James Version of the Bible by candlelight, and the most exciting thing they do all week is go to the bathroom. I don't know, right? We wonder, we wrestle with what a holy person would look like. And so we usually don't think about holiness, or if we do, we don't always have positive connotations. But pursuing holiness, growing in personal holiness, this is a basic concept of the Christian life. But it seems to be one that we either dismiss on the one hand or distort on the other. Either we think it's not that important. We dismiss it. We think, well, we're focused on grace here at South Point. And so because of grace, I don't really get caught up on or sweat holiness much because one drop of the blood of Jesus was enough to cover all my sins. And I dismiss the notion of holiness. Others of us, we don't dismiss it, but we distort it. We come up with a long to-do list. We think I should do this, I should be like this. I say we should all over ourselves about what we ought to be and could be. We distort it. But at the end of the day, holiness is simply responding to who God is. God is a holy God. You cannot get away from His holiness. We have to deal with it. Now, interestingly, people love to talk about different characteristics and attributes of God. We love to talk about the fact that God is loving. We love to talk about the fact that God is merciful, or God is powerful, or God is wise. But you don't hear a lot of people excitedly talking about God's holiness. And yet, of all the character traits of God, only His holiness is referred to the third degree in Scripture. In Isaiah chapter 6, the seraphim declare God as holy, holy, holy. God has never called love, 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 or mercy, 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 or wise, wise, wise. Holiness is the defining feature of his other attributes. For instance, God's love isn't any love, it's a holy love. God's wisdom isn't any wisdom, it's a holy wisdom. But when we hear the word holiness, a lot of times there are a lot of negative connotations in our minds. We think of things like holier than thou. We think about sanctimonious people, self-righteous people. But you can't get away from the fact that some of the evidence that we're actually in a relationship with Jesus at all is that Jesus' holiness begins to show up in our lives. So how should we respond to the holiness of God? 1 Peter 1 says, we should be holy as God is holy. But how do we even understand what that means? What do we do with it? Some of us, we hear the concept of holiness and we're afraid of it. It's like something foreboding and scary. And we think we might have to change, and so we don't want to get too near it. Others of us, we're not afraid, we're ashamed. We know how terrible we have messed up. We think we're terrible people. Heck, we're terrible Christians. We always feel like failures as Christians. And so we're ashamed of it. Others of us, we've been abused by some religious concept of it that didn't draw us into greater life, but it beat the life out of us. I'll never forget engaging with one of my neighbors when I lived in Atlanta about who Jesus was and him telling me that one night he came home drunk from a party when he was like 17. His dad had a large family Bible and his dad literally beat him senseless with the Bible. That's abuse. So we hear some people talk about holiness and typically we look at ourselves and go, oh man, I feel so ashamed. I need to straighten up. Get my act together. But here's the thing. Even though some of us distort it, some of us dismiss it, some of us are afraid of it, some of us are ashamed of it, some of us have been abused by it, the bottom line is no one comes into contact with Jesus and remains unchanged. Well, the text this morning I'm going to be teaching off of is found in John chapter 12. It's a story about responding to the holiness of Jesus. In fact, in my opinion, this is one of the most beautiful, one of the most touching stories in all of Scripture. It is stunningly breathtaking. It's a stunningly breathtaking picture of what it means to follow Jesus. It puts into vivid descriptors what it looks like to make Jesus the unavoidable issue. Now, let me give you a little bit of context. In John chapter 11, Jesus raised Lazarus from the dead. Now, John chapter 12 happens. Jesus is only about 2 weeks away from his own death, and he has some friends with him. You'll remember that Lazarus, whom he raised from the dead, had two sisters. One's named Martha, one's named Mary. Martha is a type A, take charge, get it done sort of personality. And Mary was more of an experiential, ethereal, artistic, dreamy type. Now, this is such a significant story in Scripture because not only is it in John's Gospel, it's also given from a different perspective in Mark chapter 14 and Matthew chapter 26. And if you read all three of these together, you get a pretty full account of the story, but we're going to focus on John chapter 12. Bear in mind as I read this, these are the very words of God. It says this, 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came, therefore, to Bethany where Lazarus was, whom Jesus had raised from the dead. So they gave a dinner for him there, dinner party. Martha served, and Lazarus was one of those reclining at the table with him. Mary, therefore, took a pound of expensive ointment made from pure nard and anointed the feet of Jesus and wiped his feet with her hair. The house was filled with the fragrance of the perfume, but Judas Iscariot, one of the disciples, he who was about to betray him, said, "Why was this ointment not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" He said this not because he cared about the poor, but because he was a thief, and having charge of the money bag, he used to help himself to what was put into it. Jesus said, "Leave her alone. so that you may keep it for the day of my burial. For the poor you will always have with you, but you will not always have me. Okay, here's a scenario. You got two sisters. You got Martha. Martha's very, very practical, okay? She's running around. She's serving. She's in charge. She's doing all the things you have to do to host a dinner party. She's checking through her to-do list with precision and efficiency, and she's focused on the task at hand. But then there's Mary. And Mary gets lost in the profundity of what's really happening. What happened to her brother, Lazarus? And then Mary does something that makes no sense at all. It is surprising. It's impractical. It's unbelievably lavish. It's something so outlandish that in a very powerful way, Mary shows us what it's like to pursue holiness. Now, I'm going to use three words to unpack this passage, and I think these three words are a descriptor of holiness for us. These three words are unconditional, extravagant, and beautiful. We'll start with unconditional. We saw in verse 3 that what happened was she poured out a pound of pure nard. What is nard? It's a very, very high-end perfume. Now, let me give you a little bit of an example of what would happen when you went to a home in the Middle East back in this day. People back then did not smell good, okay? Think about it. They lived in a desert climate. They did not bathe very regularly. There was no deodorant. There was no toothpaste. And so you think, well, if everybody stunk, they were used to it. No, they didn't. Everybody stunk, and nobody got used to it. You ever get used to somebody's morning breath? Nope, you don't, do you? Even though you smelt it 100 times. So what would happen was, if you went to somebody's house, you would come there. They would have some olive oil with just a little bit of nard or something in it. They would take a little dab. They'd put it on your forehead, wipe it around a little bit to sort of envelop you in this protective shield and push the funk away from you. Okay? Now, she does something that's way beyond that. In fact, everybody in the room's jaw dropped. They were blown away. They couldn't believe it. And it became an instant scandal. In Mark's account of this, it says that they were indignant. That's a word used for a reaction over a deep injustice. In Mark's account, it says they rebuked her harshly. In Matthew's account, it says that they screamed. What a waste! In fact, the word scream means to bellow or snort like an animal. What she did to Jesus was so outrageous, so shameful, so over the top that pretty much the whole room stopped what they were doing and they in unison screamed at her in disgust. What was so bad? Well, in Mark 14, it says that she broke the box that the nard was in. Now, think about it this way. It was an alabaster box. If you've ever been to the Middle East, I bought alabaster stuff. It's a very soft stone, like soapstone almost. And the liquid would have been in this box. And so if you break it, it all goes out. Mark 14, verse 3 says, a woman came with an alabaster flask of ointment of pure nard, very costly. She broke the flask and poured it over his head. So if you break the container, you don't put a little dab on their head. All of it comes out. It means that you're using everything, that there's nothing held back. You were offering all so that nothing was left. There was no reserves. There was no hedging your bets. There was no fine print for you to get a loophole to slide out from under. There was no prenup in case you changed your mind. She laid it all on the line. And the reason this was such a big deal and so offensive to people was because it was so expensive. 300 denarii, what does that mean? That's a year's wages. Now, I would guess nobody in here owns something in your home that's worth a year's worth of your salary. This easily would have been the most expensive thing they had. And because it was in an alabaster, kind of a rare box, that lets us know that this was probably essentially an heirloom that had been passed down from generation to generation. In fact, what was in that box? It was the entire financial security of the family. So what that meant was, if there was a famine, or if someone invaded Israel, it meant that if there's no way to get money, your family wouldn't starve. You remember in those days, all that stuff could happen regularly in your lifetime, famine and invasions and whatnot. It was a hedge against disaster. It was the insurance policy in a day when they weren't insurance policies. And she gave it all. You know, when she would have brought it out, it was so valuable. It's like your 401k that people saw her and went, oh, wow, that's right. This is Jesus. She's not going to put olive oil on him. She's going to use the real nard. But it's kind of like maybe taking some money out of your 401k and giving it to somebody. People are like, oh, my gosh, you're so generous. But that's when she did the unthinkable. And what she did was so over the top, it violated everybody's sense of propriety. She breaks the whole box, and perfume goes on his head, on his feet, everywhere. But not only did she break it, the next thing she did was really scandalous because she put it on his feet. Now, in that culture, the feet are considered unclean. If you've ever been on a mission trip to the Middle East or the Far East, first thing they tell you is, when you cross your legs, cross like this, don't hold your foot out, because showing the bottom of your foot to someone in the Middle East or the Far East is like giving them the middle finger. It's very demeaning to touch someone's feet. And that's why the disciples, just a chapter later, are scandalized when Jesus gets down on his knees and begins to wash their feet. But then she goes further. She lets her hair down. In public, that was a whole nother scandal. I'll get to that in just a second. So in all three of these things, when she comes to Jesus, she says, here's my most expensive possession. And then she says, I'm going to touch your feet. That's my dignity. And then she lets her hair down. That's my intimacy. She's saying to Jesus, I am going to respond to you with no conditions. I'm going to offer you my all. I give you my all. I follow you fully. There's nothing in my life, nothing I'm holding back. There's nothing in my future that I'm holding back. There's nothing in my desires that's off limits to you. Here, it's all yours. And so when she's pouring out that perfume, she's saying, I'm going to follow you without conditions. I'm going to follow you without stipulations. I'm going to follow you without saying, God, you're being unreasonable, and that's asking too much, and you're going too far. I will stand before you in absolute, unconditional surrender, and I will not be conditioned to respond to you by what it costs me. I'm willing to give up everything. I'm willing to give you anything, not just like 10% of my salary. What she's saying is, I'll follow you whatever it costs. But then when she goes to his feet, she moves past the alabaster box into his feet. It's not unconditional, it's extravagant. Now you have to understand something about how offensive it is to touch somebody's feet in the Middle East. In the Old Testament, there were slaves. Now don't think the slaves we had in the American South during the Civil War, they had a different type of slavery. In that day, if you got into somebody's debt, you didn't declare bankruptcy. You had to go become their slave until you worked it off. And slaves still had rights. And one of the rights that a slave had was they don't have to touch the feet of their master, because that is a supreme indignity in that culture. So when she poured it over his feet, what she's saying is, Jesus, even servants have rights. But I want to give up those rights. I give up all control to you. I give up every right of self-determination. Whatever you determine, you are God. I'm not. You are the Lord. I'm not. And I'm going to follow you. But then she goes a step further. Because what's astounding is then she lets her hair down. And that's what really scandalized everybody. Because in those days, I mean, in the Middle East today, you see women, they wear burqas on their head. They wear their hair up and covered. In fact, in that day, if you let your hair down in public, it was grounds for divorce. It was a scandal. And the reason was, when a woman unbound her hair, it was a way of showing openness and intimacy and love, and you could only do it in the privacy of your home with your most intimate family members. That's what it meant in that culture. Let me apply this. You know, it's possible to think you're following Jesus, to think you've gone all the way with Jesus. You say, okay, Jesus, I've come to the point where I realize you're the Lord, I'm not, you have the right to all of me, all that I have, all that I do. And you might even take it a step further. You may say, okay, I'll give up my right of control. I will obey what you say. I will submit to what you send unconditionally. And yet, there's still something you're holding back. You're still resentful about the whole thing. You don't like it. You do it, but you do it in a tight-lipped kind of way where you're just sort of sucking it up, white-knuckling your way into some sort of obedience. You can give it and say, I owe it, therefore I won't hold on to it. You're obedient, but you're still holding on to your heart. You're still not making Jesus the ultimate thing you delight in. You see, this is what Mary's saying, and what this is so profound. Mary's saying, I'm not just going to give you all that I have, the nard. I'm going to give you all that I am. I'm not just going to give you control. I'm going to put all of my hopes and all of my dreams in you, and I'm going to love you because you love me. And I'm not just going to try to do your will. I'm going to make you the deepest delight of my heart. It won't be in my spouse. It won't be in my children. It won't be in my job. It won't be in my dreams. It's in you. Because this is amazing, because what she's saying is, I am coming to you and I'm willing to rebuild my entire identity around you. I'm not just going to give you my will. I'm going to make you my deepest delight. Now, John's interesting here because, unlike the other Gospels, John focuses on Judas. And the commentators say there's a reason for what John does narratively. Narratively, when John focuses on Judas, what he's saying is, when it comes to our relationship with Jesus, there's only two options. You're either like Judas, selling out Jesus, or you're like Mary, being sold out for Jesus. Either you're a religious consumer who's pragmatically looking for what Jesus offers, because that's what Judas was. Or you're not a consumer, you're being consumed by the love of one for you, which is what Mary did. So you're either like Judas, using Jesus to get what you really want, Jesus is a tool, or you're in love with him and you're offering yourself to him to be used for what he wants. And it's in this response you learn what holiness looks like. Because when we think about holiness, don't most of us think about morality, a list of things that we should be doing, a list of things we ought to be doing? Holiness, I mean, it is that, but that's not its primary use. The word holy means to be set apart. It means to, you think about the temple, for instance. It was a holy building. Why? Because it was set apart from other buildings and set apart to be used by God. And so holiness, it's not your record. It's not like you say, okay, morally, this last week I was about a C minus or a D plus. So now this week, February the 3rd week, I'm going to aim for like a B minus or B plus. No. Holiness means, am I wholly following God? Have I said, Lord, you have the right to every part of me. I'm not going to sequester off parts of me and say, you can't come here. Holiness means, you know, Am I following God as long as he's working for me? I'm following God as long as he gives me what I want. I'm following God as long as my life is like I think it should be. I'm following God as long as he's not asking too much of me. I'm following God as long as it doesn't cost that much. Am I obeying God because I love him? Or am I using God to try to stay on his good side so he'll give me what I really want out of life? Am I following him for his sake, or am I following him for my sake? Am I using him to get to my goals, or am I offering myself up for him so he can achieve his goals in me and through me? Holiness is saying, God, no matter what you say to me, Lord, no matter where you send me, you're the Lord, and I love you. And I want to follow you. And I'm not just going to give you my will. I'm going to give you my heart. All right, how do you do that, right? Where does that come from? I can't do that. That's my willpower doesn't have that in me. Now, let me say this. I want to speak to you. If you're here this morning, you're not a Christian. Number one, you're not alone. We have lots of people who come to us. This is a safe place for you to wrestle. I hope you feel safe to not be a Christian here, and you can wrestle through what does it mean to be a Christian. But I want to ask you this. If you're not even sure there is a God, the question I have is, would you be willing to follow a God that is so good that he would elicit a response like this? Would you say, God, if you really are such a extravagantly loving God that a woman could encounter you and respond like this, I'm willing to at least find out about you. But holiness is not fundamentally about keeping the rules. Holiness is about belonging to him, to be set apart for him and his purposes. And so how did Mary get that way? I mean, how do we know Mary wasn't just a fanatic, right? I mean, we live in a world where religious people strap explosives to themselves all the time and make the ultimate sacrifice. And we call them dangerous fanatics. And maybe as I'm talking about Mary, you're going like, yeah, she's kind of a fanatic too. No, she's not. There is nothing that's religiously fanatical about what she did. Here's why. Fanaticism can't produce love. And remember who was most perplexed. Remember who was most angry by what she did. It was the religious people. One of my favorite writers, Tim Keller, says about this passage, religious people come to God's feet, but they never let down their hair. He suggests that the problem was with her hair, letting down her hair. Why? Because she was so confident. Did you know that religious people are not confident before God? Religious people are always trying to work to get God's blessing. They're always trying to do what's right, trying to earn the way. Mary could care less what the culture thinks. She doesn't care what the men in the room think. She doesn't care what her sister Martha thinks. Can you imagine Martha? Mary, what are you doing? You know? She doesn't care. Mary only cares what Jesus thinks. And she already knows what he thinks. She knows that she is loved beyond measure. That's why religion is so consumed with what people think. Religion is so consumed with your reputation. Keeping it together, appearing in control like you're in perspective. Religious people are so concerned with what other people think because their whole identity is wrapped up in their religious performance. And so religious people don't know anything about the sort of self-forgetful confidence that just walks into the presence of Jesus, gives him all, falls on her feet, extravagantly loves him, and then intimately gives him something. Religion can't produce intimacy. Religion robs you of it. Because religious people aren't confident and they aren't humble. But you know what? If you live under the shadow of the cross, it produces both incredible humility and incredible confidence. Why? When you look at the cross and you see the Son of God hanging there, and you say, it was my sin that put him there, that humbles you. And yet it also produces confidence. You know why? Because you see the Son of God hanging on the cross and you think, I was loved that much. So I'm literally coming to the cross humbled, bold. Humbled, bold. And there she is at his feet. And she doesn't care what anybody thinks but Jesus. Where does that come from? Why? How do you get there? I think the key is found in verse 7. It says, Jesus says, leave her alone so that she may keep it for the day of my burial. For the poor you always have with you, but you do not always have me. This is not, by the way, a who cares about the poor verse. This assumes the poor are very important. But what he's saying is unique among all. He's saying, she knows I'm about to be buried. She's clued in on something. I mean, the thing about Mary is you watch her. There's a progression in Mary. And every time you see Mary, she's at the feet of Jesus, right? In Luke 10, she's a listener. She's learning, studying. Martha's getting mad at her. Then in John 11, Lazarus dies. Martha runs at Jesus' feet and says, angrily, if you would have been here, Lazarus wouldn't have died. Kind of throwing some blame. Now, Mary says the exact same thing Martha says, but instead of being angry, she falls at his feet in submission and didn't say anything else. She just weeps. Why? See, I think Mary, in sitting at the feet of Jesus, is way ahead of everybody else. And in this instance, I think what she is saying is, you know, Lord, she's saying, Lord, I realize something. I understand that you just raised my brother from the dead. But I know for you to raise him from the dead, for you to give us life, you're going to have to die. You're going to have to lay your life down. And so where does holiness come from? It didn't come from your willpower, from redoubling your efforts to keep more rules. It comes from perceiving who he is, what he's done. It comes from seeing that he poured out everything for us at the cross, that he paid the ultimate price, that he invited us into the deepest intimacy. And that's the beauty part. She'd stared into the beauty of who he was and what he had done. And as she gazed into his beauty, she became like him. You know, what you revere, you will resemble. Either for ruin or restoration. Whatever you're revering, you're going to start resembling that. And if you revere the gracious, loving, agape heart of God, you revere that, you'll start resembling that for restoration. You start revering anything else, your reputation, your money, your stuff, your body, whatever, you're going to resemble that for ruin. So we've got to make a decision, every one of us here. Are we using him to get what we really want? Or are we worshiping him because he is a true object of our desire? Now, this doesn't mean to be perfect. We're a perfect place for imperfect people, right? Mary wasn't perfect, but she set herself apart. And she was able to pour herself out because he poured himself out. And you can be like her. Not a fanatic, not a pragmatist, but rather one who is lost in the wonder of his beauty, in the extravagant outpouring of his love. Look at what he's done for you. You see, we're about to take communion here. This shows us that this is not theoretical what I'm talking about. What happened is as real as the elements we're going to be partaking of. And so when we take communion, we're saying, Lord, I'm going to let you pour your most expensive ointment on me. Forgiveness, love, intimacy. And now I want to walk back giving you all that I am. Take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee. Take my silver, take my gold, not a mite would I withhold. Take my moments and my days, let them flow in ceaseless praise. We're offering ourselves back to God as we receive what he's offered of himself to us. And that's why I love this meal. Because Jesus, on the night he was betrayed, he didn't give us just a little dab, but he let himself be ripped and torn asunder. He said, "This is my body broken for you. Take and eat." And in the same way, he wasn't stingy with his blood. But he said, this cup represents the new covenant in my blood. Take and drink. For as often as you eat this food, eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim my death until I come." This is a reminder